The constant temperature over several weeks' time develops in a golden form of energy with the same vibrations as our vital energy. This energy stands far above atomic energy. It has taken millions of years for gold to develop from the ordinary coarse matter of the earth through an exceedingly slow process. If we develop this process further, we can transform the gold into another material charged with the very highest form of energy. Just as one can magnetize a piece of ordinary iron, we can also develop ordinary gold into magnetic or living gold. The magnetism of the gold, however, represents a much higher energy than the magnetism found in iron. It has the same vibrations as our own vital energy. In fact, it is life itself and has a miraculous effect on all living creatures. Man may be likened to a living magnet charged with this very highest form of energy. Just as a magnet loses its charge in time, but can be re-magnetized by passing an electric current around it, in the same way human beings can be recharged with this energy. The seat of this vital energy is the marrow in the spinal column. In your fall from your horse, this very delicate organ was injured and the tension of your vital energy fell abruptly. Your organism was unable to recover, because the healing centers themselves were injured. These pills recharged your nerve centers, natural processes were set in motion, and now you are well. That's all there is to it. See what these pills do for the Maharaja. In spite of his very advanced age, he wants to keep on demonstrating his many powers every day with his favorite wife. With the help of these gold pills, he still retains the powers of a young man. Unaided nature is no longer able to supply his body with this energy, but this preparation sets his nerve centers in motion, and that is sufficient to recharge his sexual organs daily. Our friend asked the Indian physician, "Why do you keep your knowledge so secret? Why can't all humanity enjoy the blessing of your science? Why don't you teach it to the English doctors who are here?" For a while the Indian physician looked off into the distance. Then he said, "Just as an egg needs to be fertilized for the life within it to be changed from a latent state into an active state, in the same way, the preparation of this gold compound requires a source of power to transform certain latent forces within the gold molecules into active ones, thus changing the inert gold into an active, vital material. This source of power is a human being himself. The power of reproduction can not only be manifested by the body, but also on another plane as energy. A hypnotist, for example, manifests his power of reproduction on a spiritual plane and can penetrate the mind of another person, causing certain forces to change from a latent state to an active state, just as a sperm cell from his body is able to unite with an ovum to set in motion a process of life within the latter. In order to set in motion a certain process in various materials, in this case gold, a person needs the radiation of his own vital energy. However, if he expends this energy through his sexual organs, he automatically puts into a latent state the very nerve centers he needs to radiate vital energy in its original, basic form. These nerves open and close automatically. A person can either channel this energy into his sexual organs or into other, higher nerve centers, but he cannot simultaneously channel it into both. You can easily understand that when a father initiates his son into this science, the son, along with his oath of silence, must take a vow of complete continence. That's why the son can only be initiated when he is already married and has several sons of his own, in order that there be no interruption in the chain of knowledge. But just show me a Western physician who would be willing to live a life of complete continence for the sake of this knowledge. On the contrary, it has been our experience that the majority of your physicians want to use their knowledge to earn as much money as possible in order to be able to satisfy their animal instincts to the maximum extent. Many Western physicians have visited us and tried all kinds of persuasion to get us to part with our secrets. We saw that with these secrets they merely wanted to earn piles of money, satisfy their vanity, or become famous. It is a sad fact that the foreign power in this country even went to the extent of torturing several of our Ayurvedic physicians in a fruitless effort to get them to reveal their secrets. Ever since then, Foreigners in India do not meet any Ayurvedic physicians, simply because none of the latter will admit that he is one or that he possesses any special knowledge. We were forced to wear masks and become mysterious Orientals. We had to pay a high price to learn this lesson. Nevertheless, I can tell you this much, all through the years there have been foreign physicians who, for high-minded, truly humanitarian reasons, sought to acquire our knowledge and were willing to take the oath of Brahmacharya, continence. These doctors have received initiation and are working with us. On the other hand, they keep their knowledge just as secret as we do. When humanity has progressed to such a point that the majority of doctors are willing to forego their sexual lusts in order to be able to heal, Indian Ayurvedic physicians will be willing to reveal this secret knowledge to them. At present, however, people in the West use all of their inventions to harm each other. Take dynamite, for example, and aeroplanes. What have they done with these things? Made them into new weapons. What would they do if they knew the secret of cosmic energy and of the still higher vital energy? They'd merely figure out new ways to kill each other off and earn still more money. War is business. And what's this business for? Why do people run after more and more money? In order to indulge their sexual pleasures, lusts and perversities to a greater extent. You ask why we do not reveal our secrets. The answer is that foreign doctors really do not want them. When they hear that they would have to give up their lusts in order to acquire this knowledge, they lose interest right away. They simply cannot believe that by paying such a cheap price they could learn the secret of all life. It's much easier for them not to bother to make a single attempt, but merely to poke ridicule at Orientals. Most of the foreigners who come to our country think that the highest happiness on earth is the satisfaction of their sexual desire. How could they ever know anything about the tremendous power that a spiritual person possesses if they never make an attempt themselves to attain it? This power cannot be acquired through either money or might. The price is renunciation. But the people who have paid this price have quickly discovered that they really did not need to give up anything. They find, on the contrary, that they have discovered immortal happiness in the place of mortal. A permanent state of pleasure instead of a transitory one. No one can make a better bargain. But we do not discuss these things. These secrets cannot be understood with the intellect alone. Spirit cannot be understood, it can only be experienced. One can only be spirit. We are content to let others travel the path of the intellect. They have already accomplished much and will still accomplish more. But the highest truth will always remain hidden for the person who merely follows his intellect and never learns the bliss of pure being to which the path of renunciation leads. People in the West have made the Oriental yogi a comic book character. Is it any wonder that the initiates do not reveal their secrets but merely withdraw and remain unreachable for Western people? I have told you all of this because I can see that you're not interested in our sciences purely out of curiosity, but rather because of deep spiritual desire. You seek the truth. You seek God. We are ready and glad to help such people. I'll give you a bit of advice. If you want to make faster progress and plunge deeper into the secrets of human life, practice yoga. The Indian doctor went on to explain that for many thousands of years the Orientals have been discovering and perfecting various methods by which people can reach the goal of happiness, a goal everyone carries in his heart regardless of how ignorant he may be or how low his individual state of consciousness. Right here on earth people can reach this fulfillment, this salvation, this state of eternal bliss, or as Orientals call it, nirvana. The door is open for every person when he finds the key. This key is yoga. Our friend's Indian doctor went on to explain that every human act or activity which is done with concentration is actually yoga, as the only way we have of reaching the great goal is through concentration. In studying yoga systematically, however, we learn techniques for developing and improving our powers of concentration, and these are methods which have been perfected through thousands of years. There are various paths in yoga, physical, mental, and spiritual exercises in concentration. These exercises develop the highest abilities of the human being, opening up his spiritual eyes, his spiritual ears, and teaching him to be master of himself. Master of creative forces. Master of the forces of fate. The pathway to happiness is opened up, or to express it another way, the path to self-realization, to God. The highest and at the same time the most difficult yoga path is that of Raja Yoga. Raja means king, and if we translate the term literally, we find that this yoga path is known as regal yoga or majestic yoga. It is the shortest path, but at the same time the steepest and bumpiest. It is the pathway Jesus taught in the Bible. With patience and perseverance, however, one reaches the goal. My husband's schoolboy friend went on with his story. The Indian physician showed me the basic exercises of yoga, the ones I showed you. But later he told me how to get into touch with one of the greatest living yogis. I went to him. He was a man over 80 years old, but he did not look to be over 40. He was a Hatha yogi. These yogis know all the secrets of the body. They are able to maintain their bodies in constant and perfect health for several hundred years if they want to. The Indians claim that in the mountains there are yogis living today who are 700 and 800 years old. My husband began to laugh. Now I'll tell one. 700 years old? Not bad at all. But at that point you woke up, right? See, our friend answered quite seriously, you are a true Occidental. Just because there are some things you haven't heard about, this doesn't mean by any manner of means that they don't exist. The Orientals know much more about the science of man than we in the West, but they have learned to keep quiet. From the time the first Occidentals arrived in the Orient, they have done all kinds of things that have made the Orientals keep silent. Even today they can still keep their secrets. I saw things in India that taught me to be very cautious about laughing other people out of court. Okay, okay, my husband answered, I believe too that there must be some way of living longer when we think that even here in the West the human lifespan is constantly being lengthened in spite of all we do to shorten it with nicotine, alcohol and wrong living habits. 50 or 60 years ago the average lifespan was 35 years. Whereas now it's around 60. Makes one wonder what the limit is. Medical science is progressing with giant strides. Who knows how far we'll go? See, your real conviction is not cynical at all. But here in the West we don't dare admit what we believe just because it isn't considered the thing to do. To talk about things we don't understand we always try to affect a superior, cynical manner. I have great respect for what our scientists know, but they act as if they knew all the secrets of life, whereas they are completely ignorant about death. The Orientals have discovered the secret of life and death, but their one and only weapon against the cynicism of the West is silence. No wonder. Here's an example. An Indian showed me a cigarette lighter. It was a little figure of Buddha sitting in the so-called lotus posture. A cheap lighter such as one could get at any bazaar. He told me, an Oriental would never use the figure of Christ for a cigarette lighter, because we feel respect for the sacred symbols of other religions, just as for our own. We know that one and the same God stands above and behind all the various sacred symbols. So saying, he gently put down the Buddha cigarette lighter on his household altar. As a Westerner, I felt deeply ashamed. And I often wonder when we in the West will wake up and have enough sense not to go on constantly insulting Orientals by such offenses against tact, respect, and good taste. Just think, too, about all our Western films that deal with the Orient. Orientals see these films too, and I'm sure you can guess what they think about them. But they are silent. I asked our friend, are there books about yoga? The most beautiful and the most sacred book of the Indians is the Bhagavad Gita. In it you can read the most beautiful description of the spiritual path to self-development through Raja Yoga. That's what I would recommend to you. I had heard enough. That very evening I wanted to begin reading the book our friend had loaned me. I lay down comfortably in bed, took the book and opened it. To my great surprise, I saw it was not the book I had chosen. I turned it around and looked at the title on the back. How strange. I had read the title while browsing through our friend's books, and I now remembered distinctly that I had taken out the book I wanted. Could I have made a mistake and pulled out the book next to it? Apparently. But now that I had this book, I wanted at least to look at it. It immediately awakened my interest. On the outside it looked like a modern book. But inside it contained a very, very old manuscript. The paper was yellow and brown with age, full of traces of worms. Both the dark black ink as well as the writing showed that the book was very old indeed. The more I read, the more surprised and excited I became. Until finally my hands fairly trembled with the enforced suspense as I devoured page after page. The manuscript told about a secret spiritual order that was as old as the earth itself. Without any external, visible form of membership, the order was constantly taking in neophytes who came in contact with it without actually knowing anything about it. This coming into contact occurred when a person reached such a state of development that he completely gave up his own person and dedicated his entire life to alleviating the sufferings of others. Whenever a person has reached this decision, a member of the secret order gets in spiritual touch with him, or rather the individual who has decided to give up his person and thus has reached universal love has reached a stage in his development such that he automatically responds to the vibrations flowing among the members of this secret spiritual fraternity. First he hears within himself the voice of the spiritual leader and guide, warning him about the difficulties, dangers and consequences of his decision. If he still sticks to his decision, this order which exists to help humanity climb up out of chaos, accepts him as a member. At first he is on probation without actually knowing it. This probationary period begins immediately and for 7 long years the neophyte is left completely on his own. During this time he has no contact with the order, no matter how much he may desire and seek it. But the various tests he must pass come one after the other. 7 of them relate to the human virtues, becoming free of sensuality, vanity, anger, covetousness, envy, sensitivity, then on the other side, th6 ability to withstand outside influences. If he passes all of these tests in spite of being entirely on his own, and if he sticks by his decision, he is considered ready to begin his work and is definitely accepted within the order. On the very same day, he learns about his acceptance through an apparent coincidence. From then on he receives thorough training and, simultaneously, specific tasks. At first these tasks are easy, and as he performs them satisfactorily, they become progressively more difficult. The tasks are very different. Some neophytes must work in public, others behind the scenes. Some roam the countryside as beggars, others are very rich. In either case they must fulfill their duties. Some work as assistants of famous discoverers, others as writers or lecturers. Some hold positions of great worldly power, while others may hold down jobs as workmen in huge factories. It can even happen that two members of the order appear to be working against each other. Such persons are not permitted to reveal in any way at all that they belong together and are in contact with each other. Sometimes they are celebrated and enjoy tremendous popularity, at other times they may live in abject misery and be subjected to privations and degradations. They must fulfill all their tasks in a completely free and impersonal manner, simply as servants within the great plan. And as they perform their tasks, they must bear full responsibility for their each and every act. They receive their assignments, but they must figure out themselves how to carry them out in complete awareness of the responsibility they bear for everything they do. The higher they rise, the greater their responsibility. Anyone who refuses to bear the responsibility for his acts and his work, and tries to unload this responsibility on another member of the order, anyone who does not recognize his work as his own, personally chosen task but tries to make it appear that he is acting on the instructions of the order or as a spiritual tool of a member of the order, Such a person is a traitor and instantly loses all contact with the Order. He does not know, however, that he has lost contact, and it is possible for him to go on for years believing himself to be an echo worker within the Order. Such persons are used by the Order to test other people and find out whether they accept and follow false prophets or whether they have progressed far enough in thinking independently and reaching their own decisions so that they weigh every word they hear and only accept it after it has passed examination. Those who follow false prophets are still blind, allowing themselves to be led by blind, and both fall by the wayside. Membership of the Order is restricted to persons who are completely self-reliant and able to resist influence. They must not be people who do good or avoid doing evil merely out of a spirit of obedience or because they expect to be rewarded and go to heaven, or because they fear punishment and want to avoid going to hell. On the contrary, the Order's members must be persons who always, in life and death, follow their own deepest conviction and act accordingly. This is because the members hear the Order's messages in their own hearts, as their own profoundest convictions. I read these lines with ever-mounting excitement. Renounce earthly pleasures? How I remembered the night when I sobbed so desperately in bed. Can one renounce them any more definitively than I did then? Sincere and deep desire to alleviate the sufferings of others? God alone knows how earnest was the vow I took that time in my room, thinking intently about the terrible sufferings of the mentally ill and the incessant, unremitting pains and troubles of all people all over the world. Now I remembered the warnings I so clearly heard then, and the awesome feeling of being alone, the desperate feeling of being completely abandoned for many long years. How many years since that time? 7 years. Yes, exactly seven. And today, this curious coincidence with the book. Coincidence? No. It was a message. A message. I was shaken to the depths of my being by this experience. As was my custom, I examined the whole matter again with my mind and intellect, for I never stopped using my intellect as a means of testing and checking. But what could my intellect say now? I knew best that all this was so. What else could my intellect do but simply recognize the facts? Even the most skeptical intellect would be silenced in the face of so many coincidences. No, I could not doubt it, I had been accepted. I was overcome by a feeling of inexpressible happiness and gratitude. I felt the grace of God, His blessing, deep humility, and a profound sense of awe. In this condition, I have remained ever since. There was light. It was strikingly noticeable that from this time on more and more people, men and women, old and young, came to me for advice on how to find their paths to happiness. More and more seekers came to me for help. I felt, however, that I was still in extreme darkness. How should I be able to help others? How should I be able to heal the many wounds in the souls of people about me if I myself had not yet solved the puzzle of life and death? The most important thing was for me to escape from my own darkness. I searched in whatever direction my inner voice advised me, and tried to make progress through reading good books. I found a book describing the secret exercises of Raja Yoga, that is, the path to the self. I wanted to begin these exercises immediately, for I had reached the point where I knew that reading is only necessary in order to know what one must do. If we want to reach the goal, the self, we must bring what we know into actuality. I wanted reality, not only beautiful descriptions and theories. On the other hand, spiritual yoga demands the strictest asceticism. I spoke with my husband. He was always my best friend and knew how vitally important it was for me to find the answer to the three great questions: whence, whither, why. He gave his consent to my ascetic exercises. My father had bought an estate in the mountains. There in the forest we had a little house into which I now moved all alone. At that time my son was away from home, studying, and returned only for holidays, while my husband was constantly traveling and saw me only at weekends. The large terrace in front of the house offered a glorious view off into the valley where the vast plains began. It was almost like looking off into infinity. At the foot of the mountain, a wide river wove its way slowly and majestically out into the distance. On the farther shore, roads and highways formed the veins and arteries of a giant body, and the cars traveling about seemed like tiny cells within the gigantic bloodstream. Everything was diminutive. The villages with their little doll houses, and the tiny, busy ant-like people. The other window looked out into the forest, where one could walk for hours and hours in the awesome silence. Pheasants often ventured up to the house, and deer frequently came quite close. At night one could hear them trotting by. Doors and windows were heavily barred against wild boar and other dangerous animals. Here I lived quite alone. Every morning I found my day's supply of fresh milk on the terrace, then went downstairs to the wood cellar, chopped my day's supply, and built a fire in my stove. Then I began my exercises. This forest house was an ideal place to practice yoga. The entire region was famous for its awe-inspiring atmosphere. The peace and quiet in the forest and the primeval purity of nature round about were so great that everyone who came by tended to rise up in spirit in contemplation and meditation, even without yoga exercises. Everyone who visited this sylvan retreat became more sensitive to higher vibrations. Their latent organs of psychic sense developed. While living here, I was able to perform without exertion the most difficult exercises in concentration and meditation. For something to study, I took a collection of old figures of the Rosicrucians dating from the 16th and 17th centuries. It was truly a treasure chest of the greatest wisdom. When I had finished my concentration exercises lasting several hours, I meditated on these wonderful symbolic representations of profoundest truth, and step by step the hidden secrets of this book revealed themselves to my marveling spiritual eyes. Another subject I studied while here in reclusion in the forest was Oriental philosophy, primarily the Vedas and the Upanishads. The long exercises in concentration and meditation helped me to penetrate, step by step, into the profoundest regions of my psyche. With these exercises, I set forces in motion which kept on working during the time I devoted to everyday activities, and even during the time I was sleeping. Sometimes as I wandered through the forest, there arose within me pictures of places I knew well without being able to identify them, for I had never seen them in this life. While I was awake, and even in my dreams at night, I saw people whom I also knew, and in some cases knew very well, but whom I had never seen in this life. Their clothing and their names were strange, and their language in which we communicated in my dreams was quite different from any language I had ever heard in this life. Whenever I sat down to meditate and turned my attention inwards, I was aware of a greenish-blue phosphorescent light within me. A light which seemed to come from the invisible eyes of a great and wonderful spirit being. An indescribable kind of strength, love and goodness radiated to me from these eyes. With a sense of absolute confidence, I plunged into this source of loving power. I felt myself in security, and without any trace of fear. I delved deeper and ever deeper into the unknown world of the unconscious. Then once, quite unexpectedly, the light drove away the darkness, which had been hiding both the past and the truth, and everything became clear. When I had seated myself to practice meditation, the phosphorescent light appeared before my inner eye as usual. Then I felt with even greater clarity than ever before that the source of light lay in the eyes of a powerful being whom I knew well. Little by little they became so clear that I no longer merely felt, I knew, that they were looking at me. I felt their glance, their brilliance, their power, their light and their love shining upon me, and in the next moment, as an effect of this glance, the last remnant of cloudy haze in my consciousness disappeared, and before me there stood, as if emerging from darkness, a majestic figure with two dark blue, infinitely deep eyes. His figure, his face and his eyes, he. Past becomes present. He stood there and looked at me calmly. This radiant glance with its heavenly peace gave me strength to bear the soul-shaking experience and the infinite joy of seeing him again. His noble face was unmoving, but his eyes were smiling at me, and I knew that he was happy that I had at last come fully awake and was seeing him again. for he has always seen me. His eyes have always been able to penetrate the mists covering my consciousness. He saw all my struggles, all my pains and sorrows, and he has never once abandoned me.